Chapter 46. Daughter was only 17 then. But though she's older now, her marriage with Lord Mountclear means misery. He ought to marry another woman. It is very extraordinary, Mr. Doncastle murmured. If you are ill, you had better go and rest yourself, Chickerel. Send in Thomas. Chickerel, who seemed to be much disturbed, then very gladly left the room, and dinner proceeded. But such was the peculiarity of the case, that, though there was in it neither murder, robbery, illness, accident, fire, or any other of the tragic and legitimate shakers of human nerves, two of the three who were gathered there sat through the meal without the least consciousness of what viands had composed it. Impressiveness depends as much upon propinquity as upon magnitude. And to have honored unawares the daughter of the vilest Antipodean miscreant and murderer would have been less discomfiting to Mrs. Doncastle than it was to make the same blunder with the daughter of a respectable servant who happened to live in her own house. Today the announcement was as the catastrophe of a story already begun, rather than as an isolated wonder. Ethelberta's words had prepared him for something, though the nature of that thing was unknown. Chickerel ought not to have kept us in ignorance of this, of course he ought not. Said Mrs. Doncastle, as soon as they were left alone. I don't see why not, replied Mr. Doncastle, who took the matter very coolly, as was his custom. Then she herself should have let it be known. Nor does that follow. You didn't tell Mrs. Peterwin that your grandfather narrowly escaped hanging for shooting his rival in a duel. Of course not. There was no reason why I should give extraneous information. Nor was there any reason why she should. As for Chickerel, he doubtless felt how unbecoming it would be to make personal remarks upon one of your guests. Ha ha ha. Well, ha 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 ha. I know this, said Mrs. Doncastle, in great anger, that if my father had been in the room, I should not have let the fact pass unnoticed, and treated him like a stranger. Would you have had her introduce Chickerel to us all round? My dear Margaret, it was a complicated position for a woman. Then she ought not to have come. There may be something in that, though she was dining out at other houses as good as ours. Well, I should have done just as she did, for the joke of the thing. Ha ha ha! It is very good, very. It was a case in which the appetite for a jest would overpower the sting of conscience in any well-constituted being that, my dear, I must maintain. I say she should not have come. Answered Mrs. Doncastle firmly. Of course I shall dismiss Chickerel. Of course you will do no such thing. I have never had a butler in the house before who suited me so well. It is a great credit to the man to have such a daughter, and I am not sure that we do not derive some luster of a humble kind from his presence in the house. But, seriously, I wonder at your short-sightedness, when you know the troubles we have had through getting new men from nobody knows where. Nay, perceiving that the breeze in the atmosphere might ultimately intensify to a palpable black squall, seemed to think it would be well to take leave of his uncle and aunt as soon as he conveniently could. Nevertheless, he was much less discomposed by the situation than by the active cause which had led to it. When Mrs. Doncastle arose, her husband said he was going to speak to Chickerel for a minute or two, and they followed his aunt upstairs. Presently Doncastle joined them. I have been talking to Chickerel, he said. It is a very curious affair, this marriage of his daughter and Lord Mountclear. The whole situation is the most astounding I have ever met with. The man is quite ill about the news. He has shown me a letter which has just reached him from his son on the same subject. Lord Mountclair's brother and this young man have actually gone off together to try to prevent the wedding, and Chickerel has asked to be allowed to go himself if he can get soon enough to the station to catch the night mail. Of course he may go if he wishes. Apostrophe, apostrophe, what a funny thing. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said the lady, with a wretchedly factitious smile. The times have taken a strange turn, when the angry parent of the comedy, who goes post-haste, to prevent the undutiful daughter's rash marriage, is a gentleman from below stairs, and the unworthy lover a peer of the realm. Apostrophe, apostrophe, nay spoke for almost the first time. I don't blame Chickerel in objecting to Lord Mountclair. I should object to him myself, if I had a daughter. I never liked him. Apostrophe, why? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mrs. Doncastle, lifting her eyelids, as if the act were a heavy task. For reasons which don't generally appear. Apostrophe, apostrophe, yes, apostrophe, said Mr. Doncastle, in a low tone. Still, we must not believe all we hear. Apostrophe, apostrophe, is Chickerel going? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Nay. He leaves in 5 or 10 minutes, apostrophe, said Doncastle. After a few further words, Nay mentioned that he was unable to stay longer that evening, and left them. When he had reached the outside of the door, he walked a little way up the pavement and back again, as if reluctant to lose sight of the street, finally standing under a lamp post, whence he could command a view of Mr. Doncastle's front. Presently a man came out in a great coat, and with a small bag in his hand. Nay, at once recognizing the person as Chickerel, went up to him. Apostrophe, Mr. Doncastle tells me you are going on a sudden journey. At what time does your train leave? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Nay asked. I go by the 10 o'clock, sir. I hope it is a third class, apostrophe, said Chickerel, though I am afraid it may not be. Apostrophe, apostrophe, it is as much as you will do to get to the station, apostrophe, said Nay, turning the face of his watch to the light. Here, come into my cab, I am driving that way. Apostrophe, apostrophe, thank you, sir, apostrophe, said Chickerel. Nay called a cab at the first opportunity, and they entered and drove along together. Neither spoke during the journey. When they were driving up to the station entrance, Nay looked again to see the hour. You have not a minute to lose, apostrophe, he said, in repressed anxiety. And your journey will be expensive. Instead of walking from Anglebury to Nulcia, you had better drive above all, don't lose time. Never mind what class the train is. Take this from me, since the emergency is great. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he handed something to Chickerel folded up small. The butler took it without inquiry, and stepped out hastily. I sincerely hope she will. Good night, Chickerel, apostrophe, continued Nay, ending his words abruptly. The cab containing him drove again towards the station gates, leaving Chickerel standing on the curb. He passed through the booking office, and looked at the paper Nay had put into his hand. It was a £5 note. Chickerel mused on the circumstance as he took his ticket and got into the train. 43. The railway, the sea, the shore beyond, by this time Sol and the Honorable Edgar Mountclair had gone far on their journey into Wessex. Engworth Court, Mountclair's destination, though several miles from Nulcia, was most easily accessible by the same route as that to the village, the latter being the place for which Sol was bound. From the few words that passed between them on the way, Mountclair became more stubborn than ever in a belief that this was a carefully laid trap of the fair Ethelberta's, to ensnare his brother without revealing to him her family ties, which it therefore behoved him to make clear, with the utmost force of representation, before the fatal union had been contracted. Being himself the Viscount's only remaining brother and near relative, the disinterestedness of his motives may be left to imagination. That there was much real excuse for his conduct must, however, be borne in mind. Whether his attempt would prevent the union was another question. He believed that, conjoined with his personal influence over the Viscount, and the importation of Sol as a firebrand, to throw between the betrothed pair, it might do so. About half an hour before sunset, the two individuals, linked by their differences, reached the point of railway at which the branch to Sandburn left the main line. They had taken tickets for Sandburn, intending to go thence to Nulsia by the steamer that plied between the two places during the summer months, making this a short and direct route. But it occurred to Mountclair on the way that, summer being over, the steamer might possibly have left off running, the wind might be too high for a small boat, and no large one might be at hand for hire. Therefore it would be safer to go by train to Anglebury, and the remaining 16 miles, by driving over the hills, even at a great loss of time. Accident, however, determined otherwise. They were in the station at the junction, inquiring of an official if the Speedwell had ceased to sail, when a countryman who had just come up from Sandburn stated that, though the Speedwell had left off for the year, there was that day another steamer at Sandburn. This steamer would of necessity return to Nulsia that evening, partly because several people from that place had been on board, and also because the Nulsia folk were waiting for groceries and draperies from London. There was not an ounce of tea, or a hundredweight of coal in the village, owing to the recent winds, which had detained the provision parcels at Sandburn, and kept the colliers up channel until the change of weather this day. To introduce necessaries by a roundabout land journey was not easy, when they had been ordered by the other and habitual route. The boat returned at 6 o'clock. So on they went to Sandburn, driving off to the pier directly they reached that place, for it was getting towards night. The steamer was there, as the man had told them, much to the relief of Sol, who, being extremely anxious to enter Nulsia before a late hour, had known that this was the only way in which it could be done. Some unforeseen incident delayed the boat, and they walked up and down the pier to wait. The prospect was gloomy enough. The wind was northeast. The sea along shore was a chalky green, though comparatively calm, this part of the coast forming a shelter from wind in its present quarter. The clouds had different velocities, and some of them shone with a coppery glare, produced by rays from the west which did not enter the inferior atmosphere at all. It was reflected on the distant waves in patches, with an effect, as if the waters were at those particular spots stained with blood. This departed, and what daylight was left to the earth, came from strange and unusual quarters of the heavens. The zenith would be bright, as if that were the place of the sun, then all overhead would close, and a whiteness in the east would give the appearance of morning, while a bank as thick as a wall barricaded the west, which looked as if it had no acquaintance with sunsets, and would blush red no more. Any other passengers? ... shouted the master of the steamboat. We must be off. It may be a dirty night. ... Sol and Mountclair went on board, and the pier receded in the dusk. Shall we have any difficulty in getting into Nulsia Bay? ... said Mountclair. Not if the wind keeps where it is for another hour or two. ... I fancy it is shifting to the eastward. ... said Sol. The captain looked as if he had thought the same thing. I hope I shall be able to get home tonight. ... said a Nulsia woman. My little children be left alone. Your missus is in a bad way, too, isn't she, skipper? ... yes. ... and you've got the doctor from Sandburn aboard. To tend her? ... yes. ... then you'll be sure to put into Nulsia, if you can? ... yes. Don't be alarmed, ma'am. We'll do what we can. But no one must boast. ... the skipper's remark was the result of an observation that the wind had at last flown to the east, the single point of the compass, whence it could affect Nulsia Bay. The result of this change was soon perceptible. About midway in their transit, the land elbowed out to a bold chalk promontory. Beyond this stretched a vertical wall of the same cliff, in a line parallel with their course. In fair weather it was possible and customary to steer close along under this hoary facade for the distance of a mile, there being 6 fathoms of water within a few boats' lengths of the precipice. But it was an ugly spot at the best of times, landward no less than seaward, the cliff rounding off at the top in vegetation, like a forehead with low-grown hair, no defined etch being provided as a warning to unwary pedestrians on the downs above. As the wind sprung up stronger, white clots could be discerned at the water level of the cliff, rising and falling against the black band of shaggy weed that formed a sort of skirting to the base of the wall. They were the first fruits of the new east blast, which shaved the face of the cliff like a razor gatherings of foam in the shape of heads, shoulders, and arms of snowy whiteness, apparently struggling to rise from the deeps, and ever sinking back to their old levels again. They reminded an observer of a drowning scene in a picture of the deluge. At some points the face of rock was hollowed in two gaping caverns, and the water began to thunder into these with a leap that was only topped by the rebound seaward again. The vessel's head was kept a little further to sea, but beyond that everything went on as usual. The precipice was still in view, and before it several huge columns of rock appeared, detached from the mass behind. Two of these were particularly noticeable in the gray air, one vertical, stout and square, the other slender and tapering. They were individualized as husband and wife by the coast men. The waves leapt up their sides like a pack of hounds. This, however, though fearful in its boisterousness, was nothing to the terrible games that sometimes went on round the knees of those giants in stone. Yet it was sufficient to cause the course of the frail steamboat to be altered, yet a little more from southwest by south, to south by west, to give the breakers a still wider berth. I wish we had gone by land, sir. 'Twould have been sure play, apostrophe said soul to Mountclear, a cat and dog friendship having arisen. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.